very much, Tanya. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IOC call on the 18th of April, 2012. On the call today, we have Jeff Newman, Stefan Hankins, Chuck Gomes, Steve Del Bianco, J. Scott Evans, Thomas Rickett, Jim Bykoff, David Heasley, Kieran Malantoville, Mary Young, Lanwe Ajawi, Deborah Hughes. From staff, we have Margie Milam, Brian Peck, Liz Gaster, and myself, Master Peregrin. We have apologies from Greg Sutton, Osvaldo Novoa, Constantinos Komaitis, and Joy Ludicat. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you. Everyone, welcome to the call. And this is Jeff Newman. I want to just give a little summary of where we are and what we hope to accomplish today. Also go into a little bit of what the GNSO Council did at the last GNSO Council meeting and just discuss how that affects, if at all, our group. So on the last call, we had started to do a little bit of a deep dive into the questions that were presented by the GAC proposal on the handling of Olympic and Red Cross names at the second level. In going through those questions, we actually, going through those questions and options, we actually came out with four key questions that were separate and apart from those that we all kind of decided were instrumental ones that we wanted additional feedback on from the Red Cross movement and the International Olympic Committee. They have come back and responded to those four questions, and so I think we'll spend the bulk of time talking about those and asking the representatives from the Olympic Committee and the Red Cross any questions we have about the answers that they've given us. Take a step back. We had a council meeting on the 12th, which was about a week ago, I guess, or it was last Thursday. And at that council meeting, a motion was proposed and passed, which basically establishes a, I guess it's sort of the initiation of the PDP, but it asks for an issue report, which I sent around the motion just a little bit ago, so everyone should have gotten that by now. At this point, that motion, which just asks for an issue report on the, it's basically to cover the following issues: the definition of the type of organizations that should receive special protection at the top and second level, if any, and policies required to protect such organizations at the top and second level. This was really in response not only to the work that we're doing, but also in response to letters that the board had gotten from the IGOs as to whether they merited special protection. Obviously, the work that we are doing specifically with the Olympic Committee and the Red Cross, some of that may be useful for this PDP, but if you kind of follow the time frames through, we think that there'll be probably a preliminary issue report out on this PDP by Prague after you take into consideration public comment periods, and then a final issue report. You're probably not talking about the initiation of a PDP on that subject until Toronto. So all of that is a long way of saying that that work is going on. At some point, this group may morph into that group, but at this point in time, the plan is just to keep going down the path that we're going to see if we can come to some sort of agreement on how to handle the Olympic and Red Cross names at the second level. And, if that PDP does get started while we're doing our work, we'll figure out what the relationship is. But at this point, I don't believe that there's going to be any real nothing is superseding the work that we're doing at this point. I guess it's a long way of saying what I tried to say. Any questions on that GNSO Council motion? Aubrey?
Yes, and thank you. I guess I have trouble understanding that. Now that the GNSO Council has requested an issues report on the entire subject, including the second level for those that may or may not merit special exception, I don't understand why this group would continue working. It just makes no sense to me. It seems that it would be superseded by the issues report.
I think ultimately, Avery, that's probably, not probably, that's a call from the GNSO Council. We as a working group have not been given instructions to stop what we're doing.
A working group?
This group is a drafting team. I think, but at this point in time, there's been no instructions from the council to stop our work. Again, it could be merged into that, but if there are any issues, I would suggest that be brought up directly with the council as opposed to dealing with it at this level. I just wanted to point it out that it's out there to let everyone know and to just pass on some news. But my recommendation is that this gets handled at that level. Mary and then Alan.
Thanks, Jeff. And I'm not quite sure what hat I'm wearing on this call, but I'm glad you mentioned that in response to Avery's question, because since this is not a formal working group of the GNSO and doesn't have a formal charter as far as I can recall, my initial question was what you said, that in terms of what happens now with this group, would it be up to the council to discuss it and then possibly give further instructions or clarifications to this group? That was one question/comment. The other comment that I had was to follow up on your briefing notes, which is that in addition to the GNSO Council's motion on the issue report for the PDP, there were the board resolutions, and of that I'm speaking not just of the decision not to further change the guidebook at this time, but also I believe there was one where the board, or at least the new GTLD program committee of the board, if I'm getting that right, asked the staff for a briefing paper of some sort on additional protections, including at the second level. So would this be something we also bring back to the council? Is this something that might affect the discussions or the work of this group, and what do we do about it? Do we wait for further clarification, or should we as a group on this call be proactive and ask whether it's the board or the council for clarification sooner rather than later, instead of going on and on only to find that maybe there are certain things we shouldn't have done?
Thanks, Mary. I mean, again, my gut reaction to all of that is that that's a council-level issue, or that all of those are council-level issues. It would be, I do think that the board, or the new program committee, whatever they call that, I do believe that they owe some sort of explanation to the council as far as what they expect the council's role and the community's role in responding to that is. But at this point, I think we're having some good discussions. And I don't want to, until we get instructions from the GNSO Council, otherwise I think the work of this group should just continue. Again, that's my own feeling. Others may disagree, and if enough people disagree, then I guess we can stop. But that's kind of why I'm throwing it out there, and that's why I put this topic on and as a first one to talk about.
Jeff, can I follow up real quick?
Sure.
Mary again.
Sure.
And I don't necessarily disagree with that. I would just hate to see a lot of time spent by this group. A lot of good work has come of it to sort of, well, on one hand coming to a standstill, but on the other hand, a lot more time and effort spent on something only to be yanked back either by the board or the council. That was my primary concern.
Yeah, and I think that's, Mary, I think it's great, and I think... I know I will, or maybe Mary, you want to send a note. Probably it's better for you to do it, to send a note to the council today, asking for that clarification. I mean, I can do it, I guess, as chair of this drafting team, but we should put it on the council's agenda for as soon as possible.
This is Dick Scott. I mean, I sort of am a little frustrated here by the whole process. I mean, we spent a considerable amount of time making a recommendation to the top level, and they, in total ignoring their own bylaw, Section 9, they provide us no reasoning why they ignored our recommendation. And they're supposed to. That hasn't been done. Now we have this confusion about what we're supposed to do and who's supposed to do it. And this kind of confusion, lack of clarity, whatever you want to call it, is what, when good work gets done, causes it, as Costa Rica is an example, to all be swept under the rug and waste a lot of time. So I think it is imperative for the GNSO or the board or someone to clearly tell us, with regard to these issues, what we are supposed to be doing. Because I, for one, have a lot of things other than this to do.
Thanks, Jay Scott. And I don't think there's anyone on this call that doesn't want or think we should have more clarity as to what our role is going forward. I do want to address the April 12th, the other motion, in a second, because I've actually asked ICANN staff now. On the last call that we had, we were told about the resolution, and we were told that the resolution did not adopt, or that the board did not adopt the GNSO Council resolution on the top level. But we were also told that the rationale would be provided that night when the resolution was posted. What it says now is that the rationale will be provided in the minutes. And for those of you that follow ICANN board minutes, sometimes they'll come out with a preliminary report first, but minutes don't usually get published for at least a month or two after the meetings actually happen. So I've asked the policy staff that supports us, Brian and Margie, to go back to ICANN Legal to see if we can at least get a rationale or their decision earlier than when they publish the minutes. I think they owe that actually to the community. I think they owe that to the GNSO Council, and I don't think they should have to wait until the minutes are published. This would be fairly unique of recent motions if they have to actually wait until the minutes are posted. That said, I do want to get to Alan and then Kieran. So let me go to Alan.
Yeah, thank you. Regarding Avery's original question, I think the question is backwards, and I stated this in the GNSO. I think the question is, should the PDP be launched while we're still doing our work? I don't think we have any choice but to do our work. A PDP for which an issue report is requested now will not be complete by the time the first GTLD is launched. There's just no way that something, especially on such a substantive issue, could be complete and have its recommendations on the table prior to the first registry agreement being signed. So assuming there will be some sort of protections put in by the time the first registry agreement is live, if not signed, I don't think we have any choice but to keep on working. That's just a given. We can't stop. Otherwise, we're by definition saying the GNSO is not going to answer the board request, and the whole issue is going to be swept under the rug for the first bunch of GTLDs. With regard to the board action, I'm not particularly surprised. I don't think that what we were recommending was going to have a sufficient impact on the real world to warrant the board taking action at that late date. So I'm not particularly surprised with the result. We'll wait and see what their rationale is and whether they say that's it or there was something else that I'm missing. Thank you. Did I stun everyone?
No, sorry, I was talking to you. That's my fault. Sorry. Jim, next?
Yeah, I was just going to say that we sent a letter to John Jeffrey on the 13th asking for the rationale, but we haven't gotten any response yet.
Thanks, Jim. I think my guess is that they'll probably respond to everyone at the same time. In the end, whatever the rationale is, they did what they did, and that's nothing we can do or should do or the council did is going to change that. So they did what they felt they needed to do. That doesn't really affect the work we do at the second level. Or maybe it does. I mean, maybe there's something in the rationale of the board resolution that says that we don't ever want any new protections. I doubt that's the case, but it's still, we should be privy to that to whatever they decided and why they decided what they did. So I think Mary, looking at the chat, Mary is going to send a note to the council to seek direction as to what their expectations are. But until other notice, I don't think any of this work is going to be wasted. I think at a minimum, certainly some of the work that we're doing can be used for the issue report that's being drafted. It certainly can be used to establish a record for future work that's done. So while I know not the ideal solution, I don't think any, and I hope that none of the work that we're doing now is wasted. I hope it's got some utility, whether it's in the immediate future or in the after a PDP. So let me go to Steve and then Alan, and then I do want to talk to some of the substance. So Alan, or sorry, Steve.
Thanks, Jeff. Steve Del Bianco here with NetChoice in the BC. The question of whether the board's reaction to our top-level resolution should govern the work of this working group is, I think, off the mark. Let's not concern ourselves with what they did or didn't do with our top-level recommendations. The task before us is second level. And at the second level, we do have a clear request by the board's committee, and that committee is authorized the same way the board is. The board's committee is asking for an issues report and for GNSO to consider whether we need new protections at second level. I think that Mary, you, and Jeff, and Chuck are correct to say that this working group doesn't respond to board resolutions. The working group responds to the council's charters and instructions. And that's all good, so we should await council's decision on how to react to that board resolution. But I want to close by saying that the work that Jeff had teed up for today in answering those four questions with respect to Red Cross and Olympics, those are answers about protection adequacy and threats at the second level, especially questions one and two. And if the Red Cross and Olympics have provided us with substantive answers about the adequacy and risks at the second level in this round, we ought to continue our work of compiling that data, because that is exactly the data that would answer the board's resolution asking for issues report at the second level, and it would assist council at responding to the board's motion on what, if anything, should be done at the second level in this round. So I see us focusing more on second level, picking up on the work we have in front of us today, and not concerning ourselves with the top level at this point. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. And one of the things that just, you know, you triggered with your comments as well is that, you know, if technically we don't respond to the board. What we are responding to right now is still the GAC original proposal of September 14th, 2011, on their proposal on handling the Olympic and Red Cross names until the council says otherwise. That's still what we're responding to.
And Jeff, to clarify, that letter you just referred to is 99% about second level and 1% about top level, and therefore we're just following that request of the GAC at this point.
Correct. Thanks, Steve. Well, I don't know about percentages, but yes, the point is that a majority, most of it is in relation to the second level. Let me go to Alan, Tom, then Thomas, then I really do want to, the Olympic Committee and Red Cross did some good hard work on what we asked them to, and I really want to give them time to kind of walk us through what they've done. So, Alan, then Thomas.
Yeah, very quickly, one of the reasons I objected to the PDP being started was that I think the vast majority of people on this group were also going to be interested in working on the PDP, and therefore there's going to be a big strain on the people, but the corollary of that is the concepts that we push forward with are likely to be carried over to the other group. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And then Thomas?
Thanks, Jeff. I'd like to echo what Steve had said, namely that we have a clear mandate to deal with the second level. And just to put this into perspective, let's assume that we don't get results on the second level in time before the first registry agreements are. Then I think the rest of the world that is very closely monitoring this process will ask us, why didn't you initiate a PDP earlier on to make sure that the results of the work can be binding as a consensus policy? So I think that, you know, although I really would like to avoid redundant work, and I think what we're doing is not redundant, I think we have to to do these two things in parallel in order to ensure that the results of both action lines can be effective. Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. And then Chuck?
Thanks, Jeff. And by the way, I'm going to lead right into what you want to do next. So, but I want to comment on several things said about the PDP and the timing of the PDP. If a PDP results in a consensus policy, then that could be implemented for new GTLDs, even if some GTLDs have been delegated already. So we shouldn't just look at the initiation, the delegation of the first new GTLD. If a consensus policy results, regardless of the timing, and we can debate about how long it'll take, I've always been overly optimistic, as Aubrey knows, and usually been wrong. But but keep in mind, if a consensus policy results, it's implementable on new GTLDs, regardless of whether some have been delegated or not. Now, Jeff, leading into where you want to go, I want to thank the both the Red Cross group and the IOC group for the submissions that they have made in advance of this meeting, and I appreciate that. But before we listen to them, I'd like to know whether we have any answer from staff regarding the question of whether the IOC and the Red Cross, Red Crescent groups can use the rights protection mechanisms in the new GTLD guidebook. That's a real fundamental question for us if we continue, and for the issues report as well as for the PDP if one is initiated.
Yeah, thanks, Chuck. And I think I'm not sure. I'll turn it to staff in a second. I think the Olympic Committee kind of addressed that in their response by listing their trademarks at the end. So the only thing that the existing rights protection mechanisms really require are actually having the trademarks. And I know there's still two languages of the UN languages that the Olympic Committee is going to follow up on. But assuming that they do have trademarks in those languages, then at least with respect to the Olympic Committee, there's nothing that would prevent them from using the existing rights protection mechanisms. I'm not sure that the Red Cross answered that question, but let me, Margie or Brian, do you guys have an answer on that?
Sure. Thanks, Jeff and Chuck. Thank you as well. When you posed the question a couple weeks ago, we actually had a meeting with a regular weekly meeting with legal right after, and that was our first on our list. We've been working with them and trying to get them to provide an answer by today's meeting. They're just about ready to provide an answer. They're circulating their final kind of drafting thinking internally. So unfortunately, we don't have something right now, but we hope to get something finalized within the next couple of days or so, and we can probably circulate that or you'll find out a way to communicate that to the group.
Yes. Thank you, Brian, and that would be great to see. Chuck? Chuck, did you have something new, or is that left over?
I'm sorry. I was on mute. I appreciate the list of trademarks because that is helpful, but I think we all understand that both organizations can use existing mechanisms if they had trademarks. One of the questions we talked about at our last meeting was really, can they use any of the existing mechanisms without a trademark, just based on international law and so forth? I know that that was a question in my mind.
Okay. Debbie, do you have a response to that? Debbie, you may be on mute.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Good afternoon, good evening, everybody. A couple quick things. I just sent around an email that I know you all haven't had a chance to take a look at to supplement our earlier submission, and we can talk about that later. So that's the first thing I wanted to let the group know. The second thing is as we indicated before, our organization is very large, and we are in the process of trying to accumulate statistics and information that's going to be helpful to this group, and so I'm going to ask for your indulgence, this drafting team's indulgence, for a couple more weeks or maybe a week to try to get additional information that would answer all these questions, most importantly, the trademark question that is being raised right now, so that we can have adequate time to survey and determine the extent of trademark protection. As we indicated in Costa Rica and before, the unique nature of the Red Cross movement and our emblem protection is not based on trademark law. We happen to have trademarks in the United States for a variety of reasons, but that's not necessary or even sought in other jurisdictions. So I would humbly ask if this drafting team would allow the movement to provide this information at a later date. We have people working on it as we speak. So I did want to address that, and it's a very real concern, obviously, for the Red Cross movement. It's the reason we needed this type of protection, because the rights protections mechanisms that are provided would only address Red Cross, as I know right now, and we are still in the process of determining what types of registrations we could offer up for the other designations, but wanted to make sure we continue to underscore that issue. That's why it was so very important for us to get these protections, because our names are more than trademarks. They happen to be trademarks, but they are protected by treaty and used for other important reasons, and strategically we haven't needed to file trademark registrations around the world based on the type of work we do. And so that's what I wanted to just share with this group, and was wondering if it would be okay if we could supplement what we've provided as soon as Stefan, Christoph, and I are able to get this research done and provide it to the team.
Yeah, thanks, Debbie, and unless anyone objects, I think it's certainly reasonable to ask for some more time. I think we've asked you to do a lot already over a two-week period, so I certainly see why no reason why not to allow you to get us more information in the coming weeks. With that said, I was wondering if I could ask, since Jim's paper is up on the screen now, for those of you that are in Adobe, I was wondering if, Jim, you could kind of walk us through the questions and the answers. You know, obviously we can all read it, but if you just at a high level could just go through it. And I know the attachments, I got the attachments separately when you sent it to me. I'm not sure. Did everyone in the group get the attachments as well? I know it was a real large file.
I got them. Alan got them.
Okay, you got them.
I don't know about
anyone else. Let me ask by just taking a poll. Did anyone not get the attachments? I think it was like 9 megabytes of attachments. Okay. Well, I know I found that helpful in looking through that this morning. So, Jim, maybe you can kind of walk us through your paper, and then I'll ask Stefan to do the same.
Yeah. It's Alan. A quick question, Jim. Is this the same? Is the version you sent around today the same as the one you sent last night, or are there differences in it?
No, exactly the same.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, the first question deals with the significance of the problem. And what we did was we have a monitoring service that we use, so we get a monthly report. We get a weekly report, but we compile it by month so that we took two representative months from last year, and just to give you an idea of what type of registrations we're seeing. At the second level, these are mostly .com, .net, and .org. We're not even going into the ccTLDs, but there are many, many more in those. And so these show like hundreds, at least hundreds a month, of which I will, and Alan raised this, there are a few that are not illegitimate. Such as a hotel on a street in Los Angeles, and perhaps some other uses that are either grandfathered or geographic, so that it's not all of these thousands are illegitimate, but most of them are. And so these are given to you for just to show the amounts that have to be contended with the existing TLDs, which are only 22, and most of them appear in .com, .net, and .org, but we also have some in .biz and .info and so on. And many of these are for pornographic and gambling. Many of these are parked and for sale, and we're constantly dealing with those, and phishing and fraudulent schemes to take advantage of the movement on a continuing basis. So I think that's the first part of it. So I think it's very significant, and I think this is illustrative of that, the exhibit. The existing rights protection mechanisms, well, I think that is partly a follow-up to the first question, and it relates to the amounts that we see not only in the reports but also on the auction sites and in other things that are brought to our attention. And to just illustrate the volume, we've attached a complaint that was filed about 10 years ago, which went against 1,800 unauthorized domain names. And we proceeded in that case, and 99% of them were canceled. But, again, that's only temporary because people go back and register again. Their investment is very minor. Our investment, the client's investment, is very large in order to monitor and to take steps against all these things through UDRPs, cease and desist letters, ACPA actions, and so on. So what we're seeing is that if it's this bad now, if you add 500 to 1,000, and some people are saying add 1,000 to 1,500, it's just going to be impossible to curtail infringement without having, a huge number of people working on a full-time basis just on this task, and that will take away from a lot of the purposes of the committee, which are not only sports but also the other humanitarian efforts that are made by the committee. So that's the second question. And also, again, I refer to the fact that since the Internet is international and these are available in every country, they violate national legislation protecting the marks in many of the countries that were on the chart that we gave you. And in many cases, also those protections extend to domain names. So the third question... Well, the third question, I think, was one that was mentioned a few times, last call and maybe even the previous call, and that is, since the protection is so limited, what effect would that have, you know, whether it would be worth it to do anything because it's so limited. But we think that even if it's only 500 new top-level domains, this is going to prevent registration of as many as 2,000 infringing domains. So I think that while this is not, you know, I'd like to see greater protection against not only identical matches of Olympic and Olympiad, but also against confusingly similar one. We think this protection will be helpful and will certainly avoid at least some of the work that will have to be done. The last question is on the languages, and we've provided registrations in, I believe, 4 of the 6 languages. The other 2 are going to take us a little more time to see whether those exist. But like the Red Cross statement, in many countries we have not pursued registration because we have protection under national legislation. And so we're going to find out about those other 2 areas, but we do have them in the 4 languages already. I can answer any questions. I'm happy to.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. And while people are getting in the queue, I see Chuck's already in there. Everyone on the team, this is the 4 questions that we had asked Jim to go back with. Let me know if you think there's more detail, or let Jim know there's more detail on any of the questions. Or ask any questions that you have. But this is, and I want to thank Jim because this is the information we had asked the Olympic Committee to collect. So let me go to Chuck. Chuck, you may be on mute.
I am. Thanks. in reading the documents, I did notice the reference to checking for confusing similarity at the second level. I'd like to point out that I don't think there's anything existing either in new GTLDs or otherwise in that regard right now at the second level. That's a top-level procedure as far as I'm aware. And I just point that out so that we're all on the same page there. The second thing then with regard to what's proposed, I wonder if there is a easy solution to all this. I mean, Jim pointed out, and this is just me thinking because I haven't tested this with the registries yet, at least not fully. Assuming that there is unique status with these two organizations in the fact that there is international treaty and national laws that make them somewhat unique, and possibly a few other organizations in the world we don't know yet, and recognizing that at least in looking at the list and as acknowledged by Jim of registrations, that there are some that are valid. A modified reserve name list like they're asking for, where there was an opportunity for an applicant to get a letter of non-objection from the relevant organization would be a relatively simple way, I think, to deal with this issue. But I know it's not as simple as I'm saying. So anyway, I just put that out there.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. And I see Jim's wants to respond. So, Jim?
Well, no, I was going to say I think Chuck's idea is a good one, and we're certainly amenable to a system such as that, which would either, I think the system we came up with in the top level was sort of similar, and we would favor consideration of a system like that with a non-objection letter or a determination that somebody's application is legitimate and doesn't violate the rights of the party. So, I mean, I'm just saying that I think Chuck's idea is very good.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Anybody else have any other questions for the Olympic Committee? Okay. And future questions may come up. So let me it's actually interesting if people are looking at the chat. There's a discussion going on between Steve and Jay Scott, which will be captured for posterity, but you know, just on what the existing protections are. Let me turn it over to Stefan. Do you want to present on behalf of the Red Cross movement, or will that be Debbie?
Well, maybe I can say a few words. Debbie, please join in and compliment if you will, please. Well, what we, as you will see, we extended a little bit our responses and merged with prior communication that we had sent during the Costa Rica event, our public comments, to begin with responding to some questions with regard to the actual legal justification and rationale for the protective regime, which is due to the designations Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal, and related names, which are covered in the 28 denominations covered in the original moratorium. Again, we do highlight that the protection of the denomination stems from public international law treaties. You know, these are universally ratified treaties. And that the global public interest that their protection represents is linked to their function their protective function of emblems of protection of the medical services of armed forces, which is really the core of the issue. It's only as a, again I've mentioned this several times. It's only as a second moment, if you like, that you know these are emblems of identification of the respective components of the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement. So, you know, this also relates to what Debbie was highlighting or reminding of earlier, which is these denominations' protection does not stem from, you know, the fact that they're registered under copyright, domestic copyright laws. It really stems from international law and domestic implementing legislation adopted at the domestic level. So that covers, I think, to some extent, the four initial questions, you know, before we come to the actual questions which were put to us a couple of weeks ago. On the issue of, you know, being able to document, you know, the actual risk of abuse that the denominations face on the internet, and you know, the actual prejudice this represents for the movement, for the International Red Cross Red Crescent movement and its components, besides, you know, the actual risk to the reputation of the organization if, you know, all kinds of organizations suddenly use the name, but also, you know, the potential material and financial prejudice that it represents, you know, necessitating, you know, large resources from the respective organizations, you know, to monitor instances of misuse and, as indicated in the paper, even to register a certain number of denominations. As is mentioned in the document, the ICRC maintains ownership of, I think it's over 250 denominations under the existing GTLD, and you know, as indicated, obviously, you know, the multiplication of first level domain names, you know, considerably increases, you know, the potential risk this would represent. As indicated by Debbie, we are in the process of, you know, collecting and putting together some more concrete data and illustrations of cases of abuse and misuse. There is work ongoing, and as Debbie is saying, the American Red Cross is collecting such illustrations, and we've asked other national Red Cross, Red Crescent societies, the British Red Cross, the French Red Cross, and others, to also provide us with, you know, the data so that we can have also examples of misuse also of the denominations in other languages than English. I mean, the cases of misuse are very frequent. I mean, it's often non-governmental organizations with a humanitarian mandate or role. It's very often medical organizations also, you know, there are substantial amounts of resources that are dedicated to pursuing this, and I don't know whether Debbie wants to speak more to that point, but we're very much committed to document this further and to submit this to you in as soon as possible. But again, you know, the specter of hundreds of new top-level domain names really, you know, certainly represents, you know, a very significant argument to the effect that there be, you know, mechanisms enshrined within the process and preventively and potentially as in the form of an annex to the registry agreement, which would reserve the denominations at the second level. To the question why existing mechanisms enshrined in the system are deemed insufficient, this is also an issue which we're working on further. Again, you know, the fact that, you know, the protection stems from public international law, and I'm not entirely familiar with the rights protection mechanisms, but I think that certainly the costs and the resources involved in the initiation and the conduct of such proceedings represents, you know, would represent a substantial investment in human and financial resources, which once again could be prohibited. And you know, these are resources which, of course, are then taken out from, you know, the budgets for humanitarian activities. And then, you know, we also need to justify these to donors. Also, I want to mention that. With regard to the third question, which was put to us, we have in the documents submitted. I'm not sure we understood fully, you know, all the options, or necessarily understood all the options. But you know, certainly the notion of the schedule of second level reserve names in the new GTLD registry agreement, I think, you know, would really be the most effective way to manage this. Certainly, you know, and this in regard to the 28 denominations found in the original moratorium. The notion that, you know, the reserved names or modified forbidden names, as I see in the document, you know, could be registered by the relevant components of the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement is also something that, you know, we're pleased to see, and you know, we'd certainly would like to maintain. And to the comment, I'm not sure who was speaking, but we were a little bit unclear when preparing, at least I was, you know, with regard to the applicability of a string similarity review at second level. I understand from the earlier comment that, you know, that this is not foreseen, but you know, if it is conceivable, you know, that at least the registries be duly instructed or recommended to look not only at, you know, the strict names, but also to, you know, what we would call and what the Geneva Conventions call, you know, imitations or denominations liable to confusion. I think this is, you know, a very important element. And, you know, if that can be worked in, I think, you know, this would be extremely important to be able to deal with. But I'm not sure I was able to find, you know, the proper documents to document, you know, how the system is exactly envisaged to function for second level. I don't know, Debbie, whether you want to add some elements to what I have said.
Sure, I'll just take a couple minutes just to try to supplement. And I'll step you all through a couple of the documents that I included before the call, which might help clarify some of the initial questions that were asked of this drafting team related to how significant or how real the problem is. What I attempted to do was to share with the group a variety of documents. And I'll just kind of explain why I included what I included so that when you're taking a look at it, you can understand the rationale that I provided. I included a document that has historical examples of domain names that are registered during times of disaster. And this is, of course, not, you know, a complete listing. This is a listing of domain names that we were able to quickly provide, really wanting to give this team the opportunity to take a look at the issue. And that the Excel spreadsheet that has those listed, it's in the first tab. And these are domain names that occurred on one given day related to the disaster in Haiti. These domain names required time and attention to review them and to take action to decide whether or not to send a cease and desist letter, to potentially engage outside counsel. And again, just to remind this group, the Red Cross works on donations, so it's what we're doing is we're taking donated dollars and allocating those donated dollars to deal with instances of fraud. So just to give you a little bit of a flavor for the potential financial impact when you're asking Red Cross, Red Crescent to take or when Red Cross, Red Crescent has to take action against fraud, that's really at the core. It's financial resources and human resources that we would prefer to have allocated towards delivering services for the movement rather than dealing with instances of fraud like this. The second tab in the spreadsheet called Red Cross Domain Names is an example of a few UDRP filings that have been filed in the past. Obviously, UDRP filings require funds to actually file the complaint and potentially outside counsel fees. So, again, shared with this group to give a sense of what at least American Red Cross has done in the past as historical backdrop. The other document that I shared with the group is an attachment called 2002-418 Red Cross Domain Names Report. And this is a report of a snapshot in time between January and March of this year of what we think are problematic domain names. We've done initial review of them. We haven't completely scrubbed them, but we are pretty confident that these are domain names that were registered without authorization, and there could be some sort of unauthorized activity or potential for unauthorized activity on the domain name. We've included domain names in this chart that are potentially pay-per-click and parked domains. We did not include in the chart any domain names that had no content, obviously wanting the chart to be as representative and helpful for this group. You know, there's tons more domain names, obviously, that are registered that have the word Red Cross in them where there's no content or do not resolve. And part of what we have to do is to monitor those, right, to see if they ever become active. And so this chart was hopefully designed to just stay focused for this group on domain names with active content that were problematic and not authorized. And so that spreadsheet 2012-418 is a snapshot in time from January to March for domain names, and this is just for the term Red Cross. It doesn't include any analysis on any of the other designations. And then finally, the final chart that I include just for your information so that you can understand the impact of the fraud that occurs on the Internet to Red Cross is a domain as a spreadsheet called Hurricane Disaster Fraud Domains 2009. And while these domain names do not, on every chart, do not include the terms Red Cross, it's just to give you a flavor of the nature of fraud that happens for charitable organizations. And the reason I share that with you is why it's so, the reason it's so important for Red Cross to get protection for its names is it frees up our movement to be able to allocate its resources to dealing with this type of fraud. And for rather than me explaining that this type of fraud occurs, I just wanted to share with the group for informational purposes, this is all the other kind of stuff that the Red Cross movement has to pay attention to, and that obviously we're not seeking any protection for that in this process. But I'm sharing it with you so that you can get a sense of when we talk about allocation of resources and why this is important to Red Cross, it's important because it allows us not to have to spend time on the domains that have the Red Cross designations in it and focus more on these types of domain names where fraud is also prevalent. And so I hope that at least these materials are helpful as you continue to consider whether or not protection for Red Cross, Red Crescent is important. If there's additional information that we could provide, please let us know. And as I just mentioned, we are in the process of determining the scope of any trademark registrations besides Red Cross that we can rely upon. As we talk about the RPMs in the new GTLD program, I'm concerned about the URS, you know, the requirements for filing a complaint require the complainant to assert trademark rights. And obviously for some of our designations, without knowing more, I'm not sure that we could offer up a trademark registration or what types of trademark-related rights that we could support for a URS. That's why we're concerned with relying on the URS as the as a way to quickly deal with fraud in the new GTLD program. Obviously, there's always the UDRP, which is much more costly, and we know that that's there. But again, based upon rights, trademark rights, and as we explained, the rights of the movement are not based in trademark rights. So that's one of the reasons why the existing RPM doesn't quite fit for the movement. The second RPM that I'll mention is the Trademark Clearinghouse, and obviously by its name is problematic for the organization to the extent that we might have difficulty offering up the evidence needed to put our names into the clearinghouse. That is another concern of the movement for being able to participate in existing RPMs in order to protect the movement. So I think these two examples are what we were trying to explain to the ICANN community about why we're requesting this special permission above and beyond the fact that we have this unique tapestry of protection. Thanks.
Thanks, Debbie. Does anybody have any questions? I think you both, Stefan and Debbie, did a good job in answering the questions, and I certainly understand the concerns. So let me just throw it out to the group. Chuck, anyone with any questions? Okay, not hearing any questions, I think this is actually a good logical place to end the call since we're running up against the hour anyway. So, Debbie, if you have, and Stefan, if you have updates to the documents, you know, feel free to send them at any point. In the meantime, we're going to seek some clarification with the GNSO Council as to our existing role, also try to get some clarification as to the rationale behind the motion, and you know, continue the discussion in 2 weeks. So the next call is scheduled for 2 weeks from today, unless you
Jeff,
do otherwise. Yes.
Yes. Could I just ask a question? This is Stefan Hankin. I just wanted to – could you just clarify maybe just, you know, where the moratorium now stands? Because I understand that with the decision of the board – at least in what you sent us originally, the applicant guidebook is not going to be modified. The moratorium, from my understanding, was foreseen for the first round only. So, what is exactly happening now? When the first round finishes, what is now the sequence of next steps expected?
From our perspective, at this point, this group was set up to respond to the GAC request for protection of the Olympic and Red Cross names at the top and second level. That request is still out there. The GNSO is still has not revoked its request to us to ask for guidance on how to respond to the GAC for these protections at the second level. So, you know, our next steps, as we said, going into Costa Rica and afterwards, is to just provide the GNSO with advice that the GNSO could take or not take. But in essence, you know, we're continuing on that path. There is some question as to, you know, the GNSO could provide advice to the board, a number of different ways that they could do that. So we're just continuing down the same path that we've been going down until unless the GNSO tells us otherwise.
Thank you. When does the first round end?
Well, that's a good question.
Stefan, this is Debbie. I'll follow up with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that we can respect the time on the call.
Yes. Yeah.
Great. Okay, thanks, Debbie. Anybody else with any questions? Okay, great. We'll talk to everyone in 2 weeks from today, and hopefully we'll have some more guidance going forward. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.